To us racing fans, he was one of the greatest drivers in the history of the sport. In Brazil, he was and still is a national hero. To the world, he was Ayrton Senna three-time Formula One world champion. To Bruno Senna, he was Uncle Ayrton.
I think being a kid, I had like my hero right there with me. My reference, the person that I wanted to be like was there and he was teaching me. At that time, I thought, I just want to do the same as he was doing.
What Ayrton did behind the wheel of a racing car left us awestruck and inspired. The shock of his death 30 years ago on the 1st of May 1994 was felt around the world. But it was felt most strongly by his family and 10-year-old Bruno. He had to learn to live without Ayrton, how to make his own way in motor racing, and to prove that he was worthy of continuing the Senna legacy.
They were not comparing me to the people that I was racing against. There was always this stigma that I was not good as good as my uncle, and that was the only thing that mattered, even if, you know, the opportunity never really came about. So I kind of had to deal with it, because the only way to prove people wrong was to have results.
Hello, I'm Tom Clarkson, and welcome to a special episode of F1 Beyond the Grid. 30 years have passed since Ayrton Senna's death, but wherever Formula One goes in the world, there is still evidence that his memory is alive and well. There are yellow, black and green flags in the grandstands, and people continue to wear his famous blue baseball cap. Recently, in Japan, some fans were even wearing replica Senna helmets and race suits. They're remembering Ayrton the driver, the triple world champion, the legend. Bruno Senna remembers his uncle, his hero, his inspiration. Bruno was only a child when Ayrton died at Imola in 1994, but he knew both sides of his character, the driven, determined world champion on track and the fun-loving friend and role model off it. What you're about to hear is a wonderful insight into Bruno's childhood with Ayrton and how his uncle inspired and influenced his own rise in the world of motor racing, a career path that had many twists and turns and led to Bruno racing in Formula One for three seasons. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Bruno, it is great to have you on the show. How are you?
Very good. It's great to speak to you. It's been a long time. I think we sort of like see each other very quickly whenever I'm in some F1 races, but it doesn't happen as often as it did before anymore. So it's really nice to have a chat.
Your own Formula One career was littered with what ifs. Most significantly, what if you'd race for Braun in 2009? But we're going to come on to that in a bit. Because on the 30th anniversary of his death, can we start this episode by celebrating your uncle, three-time world champion Ayrton Senna? He had a big influence on you at a very influential age. What are your memories of him?
Where to start? Myself, as everybody else, we all saw Ayrton doing his thing on TV, on races, and thinking, how the hell is he doing this? I think my best memories from him are when he was back at home. You know, it was his time when he was not like in his shell. He was like completely open and with the family, and we were having a good time. He was just like a big kid, to be honest. You know, he just wanted to have fun, play around, make jokes, pull pranks on everybody, playing with go-karts in the farm. That didn't happen as often as I would like to, because of course he was not home as much as we would like. But whenever he was here in Brazil for the end of the year, we were always having a good time. He wanted to teach things by experience. He didn't want to be like a lecturer. He wanted to be someone who sort of like made you experience something, and then you'd go and have your own understanding of it, and then he would sort of try and improve on it. This is what he did to me in so many ways, like go-karting, engines, mechanical stuff, jet ski, anything that he was playing with us with. He was always trying to teach us in a way, and it was so much fun.
I read a great quote from him where he said, "We're all kids. Just as you get older, the toys change."
Yeah, definitely. I think he understood that very well. I think because his life was so serious most of the time with the competition and so dedicated all the time. You know, he was so focused on being the best and working so hard for it. Whenever he could sort of like get out of it, he was a kid again. You know, I think he was like going back to his childhood, and I'm glad we were part of it, to be honest.
He once said in an interview, if you think I'm fast, you should see my nephew.
No pressure, right?
Yeah. But can you remember how you felt, first of all, when you heard that for the first time?
Well, I think when I heard that the first time, I was actually starting my racing career. I don't think that's exactly what I needed to hear at that point, because the pressure was already pretty high. But, you know, it gave me so much encouragement that someone like him would think that I was, you know, obviously very quick. And I remember when I was a kid and we were playing go-karts together, you know, I could match his lap times and we could play around together when we were like driving the 125cc go-karts. Obviously, I had lots of lead on my go-kart and the pedals were like all the way back and everything. So it was a bit different, but it was, you know, at that point, it was just fun and I was having a good time. And once it became serious work, obviously the pressure was on. And that quote gave me some encouragement, but it was also a lot of pressure.
The comment suggests that you actually had a very close relationship with him. Did you feel that at the time?
Of course, he was someone who was like a family guy. You know, whenever he came home, he wanted to be with all the family, with like me and my sisters, and of course, the rest of the family. And he would give everybody time. But we had a different thing, which was the racing. You know, we were playing with mechanical things together. It was something that he enjoyed a lot, and I could actually partake with him so well. You know, I was like always there whenever he was playing with something mechanical, not only go-karts, but, you know, engines, tires, his remote-controlled models, all these things. We were like, I was always with him, and we shared in that passion. And I think that sort of gave us a bond, which was a bit different from Bianca, my older sister. She was a bit older, so she had a different relationship with him. My little sister Paola had a different relationship with him. We had this thing that was kind of like ours because we were like racer guys, just having the same common interests. And for me, it was amazing.
You were very young, single digits at the time. Did you ever attend a Grand Prix with him?
Yeah, I only went to practice in 1993 when he was at McLaren. I remember him putting me inside the car. And obviously, I was like inside the seat and I could only see like the bottom of the steering wheel, basically. And it was the first time I was like had the experience of being in a race car. And it was really cool. And then in 1994, we actually came to the track again. It was the second time I came to Interlagos during the F1 race. So honestly, it was just, for me as a kid, it was like incredible, was, like an amazing experience.
Were you taken aback by the way people reacted to him? Not just people in Formula One, but the Brazilian fans. Can you remember that?
The thing that sort of put it in perspective to me, really, was when he won Interlagos in 1991.
Yes, Ayrton Senna achieves his ambition to win the Brazilian Grand Prix. Senna has won. Vencedor, winner. Ayrton Senna in Brazil. This is what he's been working for all his career, and he's now achieved it.
That's when I really sort of like understood just how big he was, because he won the race there and we could see it on TV. But if you don't have like the experience in person, it's so hard to understand it. And after he won the race, when he came back home, you know, he was tired. He was like inside the house and trying to recover. And then we were all together with him. He was super happy, but he was so tired. And there was maybe 5,000 people outside of the door of the house, just on the street. Partying, you know, there was like a massive party there. The whole street was taken by people. As tired as he was, he came over, he like got on the wall of the house, and then he was like there and celebrating with all these people. That sort of put things into perspective in a way. And even at that age, I was only like 7 years old, still like I was like, wow, this is something absolutely amazing.
You raced with him at the farm on the kart track there. Did you ever discuss becoming a racing driver with him?
To be fair with you, it was quite interesting, because I think being a kid, you know, I had like my hero right there with me, right? Which is something that's so rare, I guess. I don't know if it's something that people can say. So I had this amazing thing where my reference, the person that I wanted to be like, was there and he was teaching me. At that time, I thought I just want to do the same as he was doing. You know, all I wanted to do is like be like that guy. Yeah, it was a weird thing because it was very special, you know. But it was also like this motivation for me to go and be like him. And you know, a lot of what I learned was also from my grandfather, because he was there all the time and he was the one who sort of like put Ayrton in the go karts. But whenever Ayrton was there, it was like this guy that I want to be like, or you know, be better than. You know, as a kid, you have like your dreams. Whenever we were on the track, the clocks came out, we were pretty close, so it was amazing.
I mean, he was a brilliant racing driver, but what else was he good at? What other sports? You know, can you give us any insight? Was he a good cook?
I'm not sure about cooking. I don't think I've ever had his food. I mean, in sports in general, he was very good. I remember him playing tennis. He was actually quite good at it, and he loved it. But if there's something that for me stood out a lot was how good he was with like flying his RC models and his little planes. This guy was like incredible, at an incredible level of doing that. So his eye-hand coordination was impeccable. Also his depth perception. And one time we were like, there's a plane strip on the farm, and maybe 150, 200 meters away, the building for the pits of the go-karts, the go-kart track is. And he flew through the pits, and there's like columns, so the plane would fit there, you know, with some margin, but it was like, just from the depth thing, the odds of him hitting a column was like super high, and he just flew through it, and I was watching it, and he was just doing all these things. That's what sort of like stood out to me. He was amazing at doing that, and whatever he wanted to do, to be honest, but that one was like incredible.
He instilled in you a desire to race. He instilled in you a desire to be competitive and to compete. So 30 years ago, Imola, 1st of May, how difficult was that for you, 10-year-old Bruno, to process?
You don't really absorb it immediately. It takes like a long time for you to understand, or at least for me anyway, that he was not there anymore. In some way, he was still there because there was so much going on about him and so on, that and because he was not at home all the time, like you miss him being there less because, you know, he was not home all the time. But, you know, with time, you sort of like understood how things change and how life changed in general from, you know, from a family perspective. I mean, immediately for me, racing was off the cards because my grandfather, who was the one who took me go-karting, he said, no more, this is done. Sort of like it took a bit of time for it to sort of like really sink in. And it was hard. I mean, he was still inspiring me every day, but he was just not doing it actively. He was doing it on a deep core memory level. And I think that's what he's been doing with people for the past 30 years. And how unbelievable is that, to be honest?
And do you still feel that today as well?
Absolutely. It's almost like he hasn't changed. You know, he's still there, sort of like whenever something happens, there's still a memory there that that kind of brings me back to that time. And from the people that I speak to about him, this is still there vividly and daily for people. And people think, wow, it's been 30 years. 30 years is like more than a generation, and it's still there, super strong.
And what is his legacy?
Apart from the racing legacy, I mean, safety in racing that sort of continued to improve after him and everything, there's the people that he inspired, that inspire their kids, and their kids inspire their kids. Even people who have never had a chance to see Ayrton, they still get inspired by him. And this kind of legacy is when you have social media bombarding people and you're exposed to all this content all the time, him being there and bringing good values to people that never had a chance to see him is something that, honestly, it's an amazing legacy. And I think the biggest one really is what he cared the most about, which was the work of the foundation in Brazil, because he understood that he was very privileged in a country like Brazil, where he would have the opportunity to, you know, have the basic needs and then be able to become what he could become, which was this amazing reference to everybody. So I think the fact that he inspired my mother to create this foundation, which gave the opportunity to millions of children in Brazil to have an education, and from then on potentially fulfill their abilities, is something that is really a legacy that hopefully will change the country for the better in the future.
And the foundation is still doing as much work today as it was 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, 30 years ago, definitely more than then now. it's a very different scenario nowadays. The foundation has done so much work, and a lot of people have picked up on that, and things have improved in that way, which is amazing. And the foundation continues to push and hopefully give people a greater opportunity for the future, which is what matters.
Well, Bruno, he was an amazing man. He inspired millions around the world, as you say. And I think a lot of people's love for Formula One today still stems from him. But can we talk about the effect that Imola 94 had on your own career? So your grandfather says no more karting. How did you feel about that? You're faster than Uncle Ayrton. That's what he said.
Well, I didn't know that then. To be fair, I mean, I was 10 years old. So it's very hard for you as a child to sort of like push through against the family. At that point, I was like driving every day, every weekend in the farm, and it was a lot of fun. And I had only done a couple of races at best. So it was not something that I was like competing. So in a way, it was like a change of a fun activity. You know, I was not competing. I was not like doing it like as a profession just yet. The first couple of years, you know, I missed it because I wanted to go play, but I was also becoming a teenager and I was having fun with my friends. And it was like, yeah, okay, I miss it. I still felt like a go-karter, but I was obviously losing this time. But I think when it really sort of like started to hit me was maybe when I was 15, 16 years old. I saw all the kids I was racing against or playing with, you know, in the go-karts, and they were like becoming pro drivers and they were competing and they were winning races. And I was like, man, you know what? I was beating those guys. Why are they winning races, becoming what I wanted to become? I thought it was like a waste of talent in a way. So that's when things really started to become difficult. And I started to try and annoy my mother and everybody, but it was quite tough in the beginning. And then, you know, my mom thought, he's just like a teenager. He wants to go be a racer boy. So she told me, just go get a go-kart in the farm. We had like some go-karts from this race that happened in like 1991. There were maybe 15 of them there, where I put like three together from all the parts that were good from the 15 go-karts. So you can imagine what level and what state things were there, because they were like, you know, almost abandoned. And that's when I started to try it. But, you know, it was tough to begin with. I was just obsessed about it. So it was quite fun.
I mean, what were you going to do with your life without racing? Had you thought about that? What were you studying?
At that point, I was like really missing it. And every time I drove a go-kart, I was like, you know, having the best time. So I thought, you know what? It doesn't look like I'm going to have the chance to become a professional racing driver. I'm just going to go work in the business of the family and then have racing as my sort of my hobby. When I was 16, 17, I was working with my grandfather in one of the car dealers that we had. I was just trying to get experience and go through different parts of the company. And at that point, I was just driving go-karts whenever I had some time. I was also going to university. I did business administration, which I absolutely hated, by the way. So, you know, it was just something that, you know, you do what you can. My mother saw that I was really trying. And I think when you're a mother and a sister, you know, in this whole situation, she was extremely brave to like even contemplate the option of letting your son go racing. So she was amazing. She was the one who spoke to Gerhard Berger, you know, ask him to give me a help.
Have you discussed it with your mother now, in hindsight, just the decision to let you go racing? Because, you know, speaking as a parent myself, I think given everything the family had been through, I find it an extraordinary decision by your mum.
We don't speak about it in that way. We kind of like joke about how crazy life has become since I went racing. A lot has just changed. And of course, in 20 years, things change. But yeah, my racing career has sort of like also in a way sort of like shifted the family around a little bit, especially my part of the family, my mother, my sisters. So yeah, definitely quite a interesting change in dynamics. I think she's quite confident that she did the right thing. She probably thought the same when Ayrton was told by my grandparents to stop racing when he had just won the championship in the UK in F3 and he was about to come back to Brazil. You know, I think she thought the same would happen to me, that he just like took his energy away, took his like, you know, his inner life away from him. I think she she was afraid that the same thing would happen to me. Hard to say. I didn't go through my whole childhood and teenage years racing as he did. But I think that's what she thought, and that's how she went about it.
How did what happened to him at Imola affect your attitude to risk?
Not at all, to be honest. When you're in the car, you understand the risks that you're taking. Even as a kid, you know, you're sort of like, obviously, the younger you are, the less you think about the risks. You know, I had gone off in the go-kart track in the farm. I had like had my big bumps there, and you know how it hurts. You know, things, obviously, I could see that things had changed a lot. Even when I started racing, every F3, F2, anything, any of these cars were like full carbon fiber monocoques, and the safety level of the racetracks was quite different. So I think the difference between me and the kids that I was racing against, first, I was a bit older than most of them, but also I probably respected the danger a bit more. I think this is something that maybe because I had this experience, it sort of like put things into a perspective for me.
And what about the 10-year hole in your racing education? Were you aware that you were on the back foot?
It was so overwhelming for me in the beginning. I had no idea why I was quick on one day, why I was not quick the other day. More often than not, I was quick. So for me, it was like, okay, there is hope there, and I can learn to sort of like be consistently quick rather than just be up and down all the time. This is something that really gave me encouragement in the beginning. But certainly, you know, when I did my third race weekend in Formula BMW in the UK in 2004, it was the third ever race weekend that I did. I qualified second in a 30-car field in mixed conditions. I could go quick, you know, and there was a strong field. But then when we came to the race, it was cold. I didn't know how to warm my tires up properly for the race start. And I went down to six and I finished the race there. You know, it was like a learning curve, and the progression was quite good when you think that I had no experience whatsoever. And my first full year of motor racing, I was in British F3, which is extremely competitive. So having podiums there and being quick, you know, quite a few times was a good victory, I think.
Definitely was. And can you tell us a little bit about the influence that Gerhard Berger had on you and on your career and any advice he gave you?
Yeah, Gerhard was, first of all, a very fun influence. You know, he told me so many stories of his time with Ayrton. So it was quite a cool experience with that. But he was also very direct, quite interesting perspective. You know, normally, I think when you have like family pushing you through something, the family is always encouraging and they're always like, you know, trying to soften the blows and things are not going so well. Gerhard was just more like straight into it. He'd, no bullshit. You know, we did some testing. He's like, yeah, you're quick, but you're like all over the place as well. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Didn't expect anything else. And then we did these races in Formula BMW. He's like, well, these kids, they're crashing too much. They're making too much of a mess. You're too old. If you have any chance of doing anything special, you need to go straight to Formula 3. And I'm like, wow, you know, when you got to F3, these kids had 10 years of go-karts at minimum, plus another 3 or 4 years of junior series, and I'm just going in there in my first year. He said, well, that's your only chance. You got to just go do it, and if you do it well there, then you have a chance. So that's how he sort of like made me go straight into it.
And do you think he was right?
I don't know. It's really difficult. I mean, as I said, I was 20 years old. In F3, the kids were like 16, 17. So that was then at least a 3-year gap between me and the other kids. I had to sort of like fast forward things, and the only way to get experience was to try and get the experience there. And I think if I got the experience in Formula BMW or F3, probably the main difference would be where in the grid I would be. Maybe in Formula BMW I would be winning more. In F3, if I was running, you know, in the top 5, top 7, it means that I was doing well. So I guess he was right.
Let's talk about winning then, because the first time I saw you race was in F3 when you were part of the support package for the 2006 Australian Grand Prix. I think there were 4 F3 races that weekend and you won 3 of them. That was a decent statement of intent.
Yeah, it was, I mean, there was no simulator, nothing like that then. So coming to the racetrack for the first time in a car that I'd never driven because it was a different car. Yeah, it was quite a challenge. There's a very funny backstory about this. I was doing the British F3 testing the day before I had to go to Australia. So I literally did a test. I think it was Autumn Park as well. And I just drove straight to Heathrow, carrying my F3 car seat with me because I would have no time to make a seat in Australia. Flew to Australia with my F3 seat in the overhead baggage bin. and my race suit that I had just used, worn to do the test. So I was like all sweaty. So it was like a full, like, bad setup. My flight was delayed. I landed in Melbourne. We rushed straight to Albert Park. I ran through the park with my luggage, my seat and everything. Got to the paddock, put my race suit on, put the seat inside the car. They did an adjustment with the belts, put everything on, went straight to the practice session. That's how that weekend started for me.
That's rock and roll.
Complete madness.
Bruno, it was brilliant madness. Was that the first time that F1 came firmly on the radar for you?
I mean, it was the first time I had the experience of being like in a proper F1 weekend competing. So yeah, doing well that weekend was awesome. Obviously, my objective was to be in F1. It was quite close to winning four races, but someone decided to dive bomb me and broke my front wheel. So I think I finished third still there on that race. But yeah, it was like it was a good time.
There was a buzz about you, and then of course you go back to England, and in British F3, you're racing for Raikkonen and Robertson. I did want to ask, did you see much of Kimi at the time?
Not at all.
Then you go to GP2, and there's one race I wanted to ask you about in GP2, when you win the Monaco feature race in 2008. I mean, I've looked at some of the YouTube footage of it. How proud a moment was that for you, given Ayrton's history in the streets of the Principality, and for you to be winning there as well?
It was quite special. I think a lot of people ask me if I thought about Ayrton whenever I was racing, whenever I was in the podium. You know, racing is so busy, so involved that you don't really have the time to think about someone else when you're driving the car, right? But when I got to the podium in Monaco, that sort of like brought back some real memories, because that was like, it's such a different podium, right? It's such a special location. The previous year in GP2, I already sort of like felt good in the track. I was like, I can do this track well. And then in 2008, I was really confident in the car and everything. So qualified second with a bad last sector from traffic. And I was like, yeah, okay, from here we can do something good. And in the race, it was not easy. You know, I pulled a nice gap to Pastor. You know, Pastor had won Monaco like already three times back then. So it was like the real reference on that racetrack. So I managed to overtake him at the start, and I managed to pull like a 5 or 6 second gap to him in the first part of the race. And then someone crashed and blocked the racetrack. So we all got bunched up together again. And I was like, my tires were used up because I used it to build the gap. And in the end, he was putting a lot of pressure. And you know, Pastor is not the one who will forego an opportunity for an overtake. So I needed to keep him right in his way. Otherwise, it would be difficult. So honestly, when I won that race, it was like such a release. I think probably the biggest release in any race victory that I had.
What is it about Senna's and Monaco?
I don't know, but up until, I think it was last year, 2 years ago, when Drugovic won in Monaco, only Senna's had won as Brazilians in Monaco, which is quite an amazing feat. So welcome, Felipe, to the club.
And did the F1 discussions accelerate after that win in Monaco?
This is quite funny. I don't know if anybody knows this. It's something that we never sort of like pushed through. But during my career in general, you know, a lot of the drivers will go and sort of like make a deal with one of the sort of like the managers that are already in F1 with all the drivers, with other teams and everything. And during my career, we had Chris Goodwin, which is an amazing guy, an amazing businessman and everything. But Chris was not like in F1. So we always had like this thing where I really wanted to do it by merit. I wanted to like have the results and have the performance that people looked at me and thought, we really want this guy. During that time, we were talking to F1 teams where we never had like an in an F1 team, which was quite interesting, especially, you know, when you consider the name and, you know, the career was actually pretty good considering how little time I had been racing beforehand. So for him, surely it was a very tough task to go and sort of like make me, like sell me in a way that was like, okay, look, this guy is doing well, and Monaco for sure helped. But GP2 was quite different from what it is now. Then we had like Bridgestone tires and everybody's pushing like crazy. It was amazing. I love GP2. I think the most fun I've had racing was in GP2 because it was just like pure fun, crazy pushing race.
Bruno, back to Gerhard Berger. At the time, he was a shareholder in the Toro Rosso team. I'd say you had a pretty good in with one of the team principals.
Well, you'd think that, but interestingly enough, I did the Macau race in Formula Renault in 2004 at the end of the year. Helmut Marko was there. I finished the race in second. It was a completely crazy race. The guy didn't do the checkered flag. Anyway, it was not like one of my most competitive performances, and I'd never been there, and I didn't like the car. But anyway, it was the fourth race in my career. Helmut came to me and he said, "You will never be good enough for Formula One." That's what he told me. And Helmut obviously was the guy who was picking drivers for the Red Bull series.
Did that spur you on, or did you actually go back to your hotel room and go, bit of soul searching?
No, I was like, wow, I'm going to prove him wrong. At that time, I was completely motivated to do it. And during the year when I raced for Christian's team in GP2, I won a race and I was leading the championship for a couple of races. He came to talk to me whenever I had a good time, but the car was not competitive, so I couldn't really fight for the championship in my first year in GP2. But things changed a little bit somehow then. Not having the best time in Christian Horner's team in GP2 sort of like also didn't have a great effect on the odds of going to a Red Bull organization. But that really kind of like put me in a funny way. So one more thing, when I met Ron Dennis before I started racing, he came to me and said, "You're too tall to be a racing driver." So I've had this sort of like reaction from people right from the beginning. And I think it was the sort of, is the way that people did it. You know, they didn't compare me to people who were racing at the time. They always compare me to Ayrton. And it's just the way it is. So what can I say?
Okay, thank you for that bit of advice, Ron. But did he try and help you in any way, given, you know, that Ayrton raced for him for 6 years? And
no, not at all. It's fine. I mean, I don't expect help from anyone. As I said, I wanted to build things from merit. I wanted to like make people believe in me. You know, I think up until GP2, I was really doing it well. And I think I was very confident that I deserved a proper shot in F1.
Right. I started this conversation by saying your F1 career was littered with what ifs. What if number one, Honda? You tested for them in Barcelona in November 2008, and you got within, I think, 0.3 of a second of Jenson Button in the other car. First up, how did the opportunity come about? And talk us through the test. Clearly, it went well.
Yeah. So this was Chris's doing, Chris Goodwin. He was the one who managed to do it. So I think he annoyed Nick Fry so much that Nick sort of like opened up the opportunity for people to be testing. You know, there was Rubens and Jensen at Honda at the time. And I think Chris was just on his ear every day there, like, come on, come on, come on. So he managed to open up an opportunity to test. And Honda decided to test me and Lucas Di Grassi to be part of the team or the program in any way in the future. So it was a three-day test in Barcelona. We shared a car on the first day. And Lucas did the second day, and I did the third day. The test went really well. I mean, Jensen was putting new tires all day long, and I put two sets of new tires during the day. So being within 2.5 tenths of Jensen, who's a world champion, was not too bad on my first time in an F1 car. After that, things had gone really well. The people from Honda were very interested, and we started to have conversations about potentially going forward in the future. We had already sort of like confirmed the test that was happening, I think, in a month and a half in Jerez. I was confirmed to do that test, but halfway through, obviously, Honda pulled out, and that never happened.
Yeah, I mean, the 5th of December 2008, they pull out of Formula One just actually days after probably you got back from Barcelona. But can you just confirm one thing? There was talk at the time that you had a contract to race for them in 2009. Was that true or false?
They sent us a contract to review. So there was like a potential contract on the table for racing for them in the next year, but we didn't have a signed contract or anything. And in any way, it wouldn't have mattered because the team was not the same anyway for the following year. So,
and the connection with Honda, given that, you know, Ayrton won all three of his world titles with Honda, that certainly wasn't lost on a lot of observers at the time. And I guess it wasn't lost on you either.
No, for me, it was an amazing opportunity. To be fair, even though that car was not competitive that year, when they took some bits of the car to sort of like simulate next year's aero package and they put slicks on, that car was awesome. It was a really nice car to drive, had an amazing gearbox, and maybe the engine wasn't the most powerful, but the car was really, really good. I drove in Jensen's seat and I was destroyed after the test. I did, I think, 140 laps and my neck was completely dead, but I was just loving life and I was like really looking forward to racing for that team. Even if it meant that, you know, we wouldn't be necessarily winning races the next year, I was super, super confident that I could do a good job for them.
So what if number two, Ross Brawn and a consortium, buys effectively the Honda team for £1? They go racing in 2009. What if you had been selected to be Jensen's teammate in 2009?
We were trying super hard, super, super hard. I mean, we had lots of meetings with Ross, and in the end, I think they went with the safe option. They didn't know exactly what they had in their hands with the car because it was like everything was very late in development. They had to sort of adapt the car to the Mercedes engine. So definitely a big challenge for the team, and I respect that, you know, at that point, if you're like organizing a race team for a Formula One championship, you will go for the safe option. They knew what they had in Rubens. They knew Rubens was competitive, was not like a poor driver, and they had Jensen. So maybe if we had done the second test in Jerez before Honda pulled out, I could have shown a lot more. But I only had one day in the car, so can't blame him, honestly.
And was Bernie Ecclestone, the boss of Formula One, was he batting for you at the time?
Yeah, Bernie was operating a little bit on the background. He was trying to create opportunities. Obviously, Bernie is Bernie. You know, you don't know what kind of things Bernie is doing. You know, I had some times when I met with him and I spoke to him and always sort of like shared what was going on. He was always giving us a hand whenever he could. But, you know, he doesn't own a team. He couldn't just like make someone put me in their cars. It was nice having Bernie's help, for sure.
So the Barcelona test had whetted your appetite for Formula One. How much of a setback was it when in 2009 you had to go sports car racing instead of Formula One racing?
It was quite funny. So Chris also managed to get me a test in DTM with Mercedes. So I did its test in Hockenheim, I think it was early 2009 or late 2008. I don't remember exactly the date now. But I did a test for them in Hockenheim and I beat the lap record in DTM then. They were very keen to have me race for them in DTM in 2009 because at that point we didn't have any other opportunities in F1. So I also did a test with Orica in endurance racing, and it went well in LMP1. At that point, I had these two opportunities, these two paths to follow. I was really concerned about being sort of stuck in DTM because I've seen drivers who'd gone to DTM and they never got out of DTM, and my objective was still F1. And I think in hindsight, it would have probably been the better option for me to go to DTM. I mean, we saw Paul Di Resta go from DTM to F1 and for quite a few years with a good support from Mercedes. DTM was always very political back then and didn't want to be stuck there in a way. But I think in hindsight, this is the, if I was to choose any different moves in my career, I think that would have been the one. There was nothing wrong with doing sports cars, but I think DTM would have been more like what I was trying to do anyway.
And what was it like for a young driver? Did you feel you had to bounce back and get an opportunity in Formula One in 2010? And if you didn't get a ride in 2010, then you know what this game is like. There's always the next big thing. And you felt you had to get in 2010.
Yeah, I was really under pressure to sort of like get back on the horse because if you're not there, you know, you're not going to go back there, really. We were looking for opportunities. I knew Adrian Campos very well. And, you know, that team had the Dallara Association. Actually, that team had a great opportunity to be a good team. And we were doing everything we could to help that team. Once we sort of like got involved, we were like trying to do everything we could to get a team to do well. It was very unfortunate that the marketing partner of that team was out of reality with their sponsorships they were bringing, like the idea of money that they could bring to the team. If we could have worked together and brought maybe 40 or 50 million euros, they thought they could bring 150 million, which was completely outside of the reality. And no matter what we told them, they didn't believe it. So the fact that they went for 150, got zero, put the team in a very difficult situation. And then, you know, that's the way things went. So it's a massive shame. That car, being a Dallara car, I am confident that the car, with the right development and the right people running it, would have been a pretty good car, and we could have done a decent job there.
Did it get very political because of the lack of money? I mean, what is it? You missed Silverstone, didn't you?
There was a lot going on there. It was a team that was struggling, and there was lots going on within the team that sort of like put a lot of pressure, but also each race they had some different issues. We didn't have any new parts, so we had loads of parts failure that people didn't see. When the car broke down, it's obvious, but we had like floors that were falling apart, so the car had like half a second off the pace, and it's because you have no downforce. I had twice a suspension failure where I just flew off the track. It's a team that was falling apart, and you're just there. I think if I didn't do that year in racing, I would have been a much more confident driver for the future, because that year destroyed my confidence completely as a driver. I mean, I was not experienced anyway. I had very little experience. And then suddenly you go into a situation where it's completely random. What's going on when you're driving was absolutely totally random. So one day you're doing well, relatively well, right, for that car. And then other days you're nowhere and you just have no idea why. So tough year for sure.
But would the opportunity initially as test and reserve driver for Lotus Renault in 2011, would that have come about if you hadn't been on the grid in 2010?
I don't know. I mean, we knew Eric Boullier from years before. Obviously, he didn't see anything, me doing anything special with the car in 2010. And he, you know, we spoke to him and he's like, oh, just, you know, come with us, be a reserve driver. So honestly, who knows? It's a real complex scenario. You know, I think if I had like much like Grosjean or Bottas, who were like sort of teammates or, you know, part of the team when I was racing, they were managed by Toto in Bottas' case or Jenny in case of Roman's case. So they had sort of like a place in the team. And I think this is the thing that we, by trying to keep everything open or any philosophy that we had, we sort of missed out on a proper opportunity to be there and have stability. And I think this is what put us in a very difficult situation in F1.
All right. Are you ready for what if number three, which is Robert Kubica has his terrible rally accident at the start of 2011. And so the second seat there is suddenly available. Nick Heidfeld gets the ride initially. What if you'd been driving that car from the start of the season, racing that car from the start of the season?
Well, the car was a lot more competitive in the beginning of the season than it was at the end of the season. The concept that they went for with the exhaust blowing in the front of the side pods to sort of like seal the floor was working better against people who were blowing the rear diffuser at that time. Then people got the rear diffuser thing working, and then the performance of that car comparatively dropped off, which is a shame. So that car, on Bridgestone rubber, would have been a lot more competitive because the Pirelli rubber was much weaker on the rear axle comparatively. So that car would have been a very strong Bridgestone car, and I loved driving that car. It was like a really, on the high-speed corner, that car was on rails. It was an amazing car. Definitely, I think we could have done better results in the season. I scored quite a few points in the end of the season, the last few races that I had, but you know, you only have 8 races out of 18. It's very hard to prove something when the car is not strong.
I mean, it finished on the podium in Melbourne with Petrov, and then again 2 weeks later in Malaysia with Heidfeld. So when you get in the car to race it at Spa for the first time, how frustrating was it that by then, as you say, people had got the blowing of the diffuser at the back sorted?
I mean, I qualified 6th in my first qualifying in F1, so it was not so bad in a proper car. There was mixed conditions again, so something that I enjoyed and I could do well on. You know, I hadn't raced for 8 months. And in the beginning of the race, I clipped my wing I think it was a Toro Rosso. I ruined my race and someone else's race as well. So it was like, a race that I could have scored points. But at that point, that car was not able to have podiums anymore. And, you know, those things really changed the perspective of things a lot.
And then at the end of the year, Kimi Raikkonen and Romain Grosjean come in and they're racing for the team in 2012. What did your prospects look like at that moment?
Yeah, we were talking to Williams for a few races. There's a good, decent chance to go racing for Williams then. Williams was not as competitive as Lotus. You know, they offered a solid foundation. They had a good engine with the Mercedes engine. So it was like something that we could discuss. And at that time, it was Adam Parr who was running things there. And then for 2012, we closed a deal with them. When we were discussing the contract, he told me, well, the one thing is that Bottas is going to do 15 out of 18 FP1s in your place. So that's the only thing. I was like, why can't he take Pastor's FP1s as well so he can share the car? He's like, well, no, that's the way it is.
That's the way it is. Take it or leave it.
Yeah, that's what 2012 was like.
You went into the season. It was like you could see the train coming. In that, did you kind of know that Bottas was going to get the ride in 13?
I didn't know that. I thought that being racing, you have always the opportunity to change things if you do well. But ultimately, the issue is that I was, you know, I had one hand tied behind my back. I didn't realize how much, but in 2011 with Lotus, I had no issues warming the tires up. We had issues with tire wear. Everybody had the tires sort of like wearing a lot on the inside. And there was a bunch of issues with the tires being the first year of Pirelli. I could sort of make the tires work and it was okay. It felt sort of normal coming from many years racing in the Bridgestone tire. In 2012, they changed the front tire a lot to combat that issue. But that meant that I was really struggling to get heat into the tires. So in qualifying 2012, I was always struggling with understeer. No matter what I did to the car, I was always struggling with a lot of understeer. And Pastor, with a more aggressive driving style, he was able to get the tires working. So he was really doing well in qualifying, and I was doing really bad in qualifying. Particularly because I was missing practice time. I could not like sort of try things and try warm up things. So I only had two sets of tires to practice whatever I wanted to practice before qualifying effectively. And to be fair, when I was there, I was so sort of like into it that I couldn't step out of it and see. And I was up, again, lack of experience. A few more years of racing after that, I could see a lot of things more clearly than I could see that in 2012. It was a real struggle, to be honest, in qualifying. In the races, I scored as many points as Pastor, and Pastor won a race. So that goes to show that when I could sort of like get things working, I was plenty competitive, but I was always coming from the back of the grid rather than going from where I should have been starting, which I would have scored so many more points just having a better time in qualifying. So 2012 definitely was a year of like potential. But I think at that point, my sort of sportive brain was really affected by the previous 3 years. And I think it kind of put me on the back foot a lot. And I was not seeing things into perspective properly.
Well, how difficult was it to do three different teams in consecutive years? What are the challenges of going to a new team? It's not just meeting new people. It's, I suppose, each team is culturally different that you've got to get used to as well.
Yeah, it was tough. To be fair, I had been jumping teams pretty much every year since I started racing, so it was not something uncommon for me. But yeah, I mean, at a certain point, you want some stability. I mean, you see people with less results getting better opportunities to sort of like have a chance in their careers than I did. So it was, it was hard. I mean, as I said before, they were not comparing me to the people that I was racing against. There was always this stigma that I was not good as my uncle, and that was the only thing that mattered. Even if, you know, the opportunity never really came about. So I kind of had to deal with it because the only way to prove people wrong was to have results. But to be fair, in any modern day sport where everything is so competitive, having any disadvantage will put you away from where you could be. And in F1, you know, having 40% less practice time than everybody else on most races is something that will definitely affect things.
You talk about the comparison with Ayrton. Did you feel that Williams, in particular, were making that comparison, given that, you know, Frank had Ayrton in the car?
I don't think so. I didn't feel that way at Williams. They were great with me. Within the constraints that we had with, like, a track time, they were giving me an opportunity. Tom McCullough was my engineer. He was amazing. He was a great guy. And Chevy, I had worked with him at Hispania before. I had a great time with Williams, with the people. Frank was also amazing. Claire and everybody was amazing. So I don't think it was coming from the team necessarily. It was coming from the sport in general. So maybe if I had gone to Toto and said, hey, Toto, would you give me an opportunity? Maybe things would have changed. I don't know if you would have taken me or not. But what I'm trying to say is that I think this political part plays a huge side in F1. And maybe I was too naive to see it.
So by the end of 2012, the feeling you're giving me is that you were kind of done with Formula One. Is that fair?
In some way, yeah. I was kind of like, it felt like I was not welcome there. I never felt part of it. Yeah, it sort of felt like it was something that was not really meant to be. And trust me, I love the cars there. The F1 cars are something else. I don't know if it's my personality or whatever, but felt like it was very hostile towards me for some reason. There was one side which was really sort of like people were like, oh, he's he's a Senna, so he's like racing royalty or whatever. This is not what I was looking for. What I wanted to was get a real chance to prove what I could do. And this is the thing that I was never getting. And I think that sort of frustrated me because I was never getting that properly.
And can we trace some of the frustration back to the second half of the 90s when you weren't karting? Had you had that karting experience, do you think you would have qualified better in Formula One because you'd have had more experience?
I don't think that karting would have done the job in terms of sort of going faster. I would have probably started racing earlier. And maybe had a different opportunity before. So I believe completely the timing when I started racing was later than it would have been. And that would have presented different opportunities to go racing. So I think this is something that surely had an effect on whatever path my career took. I think the racing experience that I lacked was not necessarily on the track only. There was some on the track, but that always comes, you know, and you learn, and every race you do, you become a more complete driver, and that's okay. But it was sort of dealing with the racing environment, understanding how to deal with pressure, how to deal with the people, how to deal with teams, how to deal with the technical side. And as much as I could learn fast, you know, I probably couldn't learn fast enough to deal with some things. As I said, in 2012, my mind was not in the right place to understand what I needed to do, not only in driving, but also how I could push the team to help me get better on the issue that I was having. 3 years later, I did Formula E, I did endurance racing. Everything that I did in F1 was so clear, and I could sort of like pick and choose the things that I've done differently, even in 2012. That would have changed things around a lot in my performance. So racing is experience.
Can you elaborate on what you think you should have done differently in Formula One?
I mean, at Williams, for instance, you know, I was struggling to get the tires working, right, in qualifying. First of all, one change that I would have done, many times I came to qualifying like completely under pressure, like under my own pressure, thinking I need to go and qualify all this time. This is like killing me for the end of the year. Like I was always, this was in my mind. This would have been completely different if I had had this sort of like serenity that I had after. And I would have gone into it with a clear mind thinking, okay, I need to do this for qualifying. So every lap that I did, I would have the opportunity to do a banker lap and then just give myself the ladder to sort of like improve. Whereas I wanted to deliver at that moment. And if I didn't deliver that in that moment, it was all wrong. So I was making more mistakes because of this, because you're just pushing above and beyond what was possible. And then there was also the technical side. I could understand how to work the tires better. I had already taken different tires to make them work, and I sort of had this different feel of what you could do to get a tire working in different conditions. And I think I could have done a better job with the Pirellis as well. So, you know, different things.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like it's a comfort factor, isn't it? It's a comfort factor in yourself. It's a comfort factor dealing with the technical side of it, dealing with the people around you, being comfortable. I mean, with the media, it's and, isn't it?
Yeah, but also knowledge, just pure experience and knowledge. And when you think about it, I got to F1 with 4.5 years of racing experience total. It's not bad, but it's also not enough, right? So I think when you think of Kimi, he had like only a little bit of car racing before that, but he'd done loads of karting before. Not taking any away from Kimi. Kimi's amazing, right? But Kimi had like a huge machine running behind him that wanted him to be there. So there's a different perspective. And when you look at it, it's quite simple. Things look much more complicated than they were, I think. And now I sort of see it.
Well, one of the things that did happen, Bruno, is you go and race sports cars with a lot of success, and in particular with Nico Prost. And I feel that that's, for the history books, that's a lovely moment when the two of you win the championship together. I'm sure the, not irony, but that moment wasn't lost on you, I guess, given the history of Ayrton and Alain.
When we understood that we were going to race together, we got together to talk and everything, and it was amazing. I mean, I had already met him in Formula E, but we were racing against each other. And in Formula E, I had loads of chats with Alain as well, and Alain is awesome. Alain is also, like, just like Gerhard, had so many stories with Ayrton, and also it was such a good time. So when we had this chance to race together, we were like, wow, this is cool. And obviously Nelsinho Piquet was also in the team. He was in a different car, but there was like a whole sort of like 80s vibe going on in that Rebellion team. So it was cool. We got along well. Together with Julian Canal, the environment in our race car, which is obviously very different from single-seaters where you're sharing the car with other two drivers, the environment in our car was amazing. It was such a great time. We were always sort of pushing each other, feeling good. And this is what won us the championship, honestly. We were consistent. I don't think we were always the fastest. But, you know, in endurance racing, we just like deliver. And we won the championship together. And it was, I'll never forget it for sure.
Well, you said earlier that you love the GP2 cars to drive. But do you think you were happiest at this particular moment at Rebellion racing with Nico?
It's different. If I'm completely honest, I enjoyed more, not a sprint race, but the sort of Grand Prix length of races. I prefer a 2-hour race to a 12-hour or 24-hour race. Sort of like you build a race and things sort of in general go in a direction. Whereas in endurance races, there's so much randomness. I don't like the randomness so much, maybe because of my previous racing experience. But GP2 was awesome because, as I said, the tires were amazing. We could just push, and it was like so much fun. I love GP2, even though it was a bit chaotic at the time. But you know, 2016 and 2017 were 2 years where felt like 2008, when I had like full confidence on my driving. I was like completely singing with my sporting side. Felt like 2008 again, and those things, and that victory particularly, like the winning the championship together. I think Monaco and that moment were the best in my career.
Brilliant. Well, Bruno, it's been brilliant to talk through it all. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for your memories of Ayrton as well. One thing we are doing this year is we have some quick fire questions. I hope you're ready for these. What else are you good at?
Flying drones. I got into this crazy thing since 2015. I love flying FPV drones and building them and everything. It's just, I took it from a bit from Ayrton with the modeling, RC modeling thing. And I just love it. It's so much fun.
Which racing driver, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
Ooh, I think James Hunt would have been quite a good chat, actually, because I see a lot of like the old races where he was still, commentating on. And he was like, it was quite funny because he was like a very aggressive driver. But when he was commentating and someone did like some aggressive move, he would be like more, oh, yeah, well, if he went off the track there, yeah, he deserved that. So it was quite a contrast in the way that he raced and the way he saw the races when he was commentating. And again, different whenever he was doing interviews. So James Hunt was a very interesting character. I'd love to talk to him.
Who would play you in a film?
Ooh. Did you watch the OC? It's like a TV series. It's 20 years old or something now, but I don't know the name of the actor, but apparently I look like him.
Actually, while we're talking films, what did you make of the Senna movie, Manish Pandey's Senna movie?
I love it. It's impossible to get Ayrton as a whole in a 1.5-hour picture, but they did a great job to show this side of him, this competitive side and everything. And they focused a lot on the rivalry with Alain. There was a lot more going on there at the same time, but we couldn't see, obviously. But, it just showed all this side of F1 and of Ayrton that people didn't know. Yeah, it's cool. And it inspired a lot of people to follow Ayrton and to want to know more about him as well.
Who is the coolest person in your contacts?
Ooh, Michael Fassbender.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Have you raced against
him? Pretty cool, right? No, I never raced against him, but yeah, we met quite a few years back.
Bruno, look, last one. Who would be your first guest if you hosted a podcast?
You. Because you know what? You know a lot about a lot of people. Tom, you are one of the few people who's able to sort of talk to people without just going over the same things or having the same subjects and not make everybody bored. So I'm sure you got some really, really good stories that you've extracted very well out of very, very interesting people. So yeah, if I ever do a podcast, my first guest will be you. Do we have a deal?
We have a deal. I would be delighted to come on. I think it would be really boring.
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it will be.
Is there any current Formula One driver who you'd like to have on a show?
Yeah, Lando. Lando is not very afraid to say what he thinks. He's like a young guy, like up and coming. I'd love to have his perspective on many things. You know, he thinks I'm an old guy and everything, so it'd be quite, you know, nice to show him some of my experience as well. But yeah, Lando is a good lad, and I think that his approach to racing is one of the ones that I like the most now. He's quick, he's you know, honest about things. Doesn't feel to me like has this sort of like ego that sort of takes over his personality, and I love that about him. He's an extremely talented guy, and for me, in my perspective, he goes about racing the right way.
Bruno, it has been great to chat. Thank you very, very much for your time. Really good to see you. Come to a Grand Prix, please. It would be fun. Do let me know if you come and we can dinner on me.
Sounds like a plan. My pleasure, Tom. Great speaking to you.
So that's dinner on me, Bruno. And then you can record the podcast with Lando while you're at the race. Now, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Bruno as much as I did. I loved his memories of Ayrton, especially the way he described that moment when the fans were gathered outside their house in Sao Paulo and Ayrton was stood on the wall talking to them. And I also loved his reflections of the what-if moments in his own racing career. I mean, what if he'd raced that rocket ship Braun in 2009? Bruno, many thanks for your time. It was great to chat and I'll see you soon. Please let me know what you think of this conversation with Bruno through all the usual means, as you did last week after the episode with Stoffel Vandoorne. Now, many of you agreed with my sentiment that Stoff should still be racing in Formula One, including JM270, who sent in this message. Stoffel is one guy, along with Pascal Wehrlein, who could have been racing in Formula One all these years on talent alone. Well, I'm glad we agree on that one, JM270, and thank you for getting in touch. Well, that's almost it for this week. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and for more memories of Ayrton Senna, why not listen to our previous interviews with Alain Prost, Damon Hill, Gerhard Berger, and more of his teammates and rivals. And of course, as we remember Ayrton Senna this week, we also remember Roland Ratzenberger, who lost his life on the same weekend in May 1994. See you all next week, when I'll be back with another great guest from the world of Formula One. Thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.